funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
True story. In 1929, American children's book author Anne Parrish was in Paris with her husband when she decided to go check out the open-air book stalls set up along the Seine. She found a copy of a book called Jack Frost and Other Stories and settled with the seller on a price of a single franc. She returned to the cafe where her husband was drinking wine and happily handed the book to him, telling him how much she had loved it as a girl. Her husband looked at that book for a moment, then silently handed it back to her, open to the blank page in the front of the book, where in pencil was written, Anne Parrish, 209 North Weber Street, Colorado Springs, Colorado. The book she had found in France was her very own copy from more than three decades earlier in the United States. This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. Kind of gives you chills, doesn't it? Does a story like that mean something, or could it simply be the product of chance? Unusual to be sure, but easily explained using math and logic. And if it is not magical, is there any coincidence that does defy explanation? Joseph Mazur is here to answer those questions. He's emeritus professor of mathematics at Marlborough College in Vermont. His new book is called Fluke, The Math and Myth of Coincidence. Joseph, welcome to Think.
So glad to be here. Thanks.
Your own life has been shaped by coincidences, not least of which was a childhood accident that, depending on how you look at it, was either supremely lucky or supremely unlucky.
Well, I think of it both ways. Mm-hmm. It was unlucky for a 12-year-old. I lost the sight of an eye in that little bit of an incident that it seems like a little bit of an incident now, but at 12, it is certainly not. And it was in some sense a coincidence because I didn't expect it. It was total surprise. And the reason it happened was that I stopped for just 1 second riding my bicycle because a stone had hit a parked car and then ricocheted toward me. But it didn't hit me. But when I stopped, the second stone did. And that was the thing that I would call a coincidence.
So, yeah, it's one of those split-second events. Had you, been 5 or 10 feet from where you were in that moment, you would not even remember this day.
Yes, and at 12, for years, you think, well, why did I stop? What if this would happen? What if that would happen? That's the kind of what if a child would explore. And I did that for quite a while. At 12, it's a very impressionable age. You're just really experimenting with life, and you see this is a kind of a damaging effect. As you age, of course, you realize, we do have two eyes. It's no big deal, except, you do want to have two.
So there are any number of things that happen to all of us throughout the course of our lifetimes, meaning that all of us have probably experienced a crazy coincidence, if not simply once, multiple times.
It seems that everyone has experienced a coincidence. The question is, what is the degree of surprise in those coincidences? I've met people who say, no, coincidences have never happened to me, never. And then you probe a little and you say, what about this? What about that? And then you find, they didn't think of it that way. They didn't think it was a coincidence, but it really was a coincidence.
You note that you have no interest in ruining the charms of a good coincidence story. You give us lots of them in the book. You like these too.
Yeah. All stories are wonderful, and that's the reason we love them. In other words, the world is so unimaginably and frighteningly vast. And just to give some impression of just how vast it is, let's just count 1 second, just 1 second. It's about the time it takes to say 1 second. And in that second, let me ask your readers, your audience, how many barcode scans worldwide just passed in that 1 second? And I bet that most people will underestimate. Now, as somebody who does radio broadcast, I'm sure your guess is probably either accurate or beyond. Most people would take a guess at, I imagine they would say maybe 1,000, maybe 10,000, maybe 50,000. And the guess is really the actual number by Nielsen estimates. That's just talking about just talking about non-cash payments and non-online payments, And when you take that, it turns out to be about 80,000 in 1 second.
Wow.
So when you think of it that way, you realize that the world is unimaginably vast. It's, you know, in the time we've been talking, millions of these barcode scans have been going off in supermarkets all over the world. So in that, you know, what happens then when you see the world that large, you get deceived by the fact that you have a small community of people that you know, that is, people who are your particular neighborhood. And I'm using neighborhood in a metaphorical way because your neighborhood goes with you wherever you are. So if you travel to a foreign country, there's a little bit of your neighborhood that comes along. You don't notice it, but it's there. And the idea here is that if we can tell coincidence stories, we bring that vast world, that frightening world, down to our own comfort level. And by hearing coincidence stories, we make the world shrink. And we crave that comfort. It's also the reason, in my opinion, why we love stories in general.
So you have a really interesting story here about a woman who had the same cab driver twice, which maybe doesn't sound like much until you explain the details. Tell us about what happened there.
Yeah. This is a woman I met at a gala, and she wanted to tell me a coincidence story because she knew I was writing coincidence stories. She knew I was writing a book about coincidence stories, and once people find out you're writing a book about coincidence stories, believe me, I get 10 a day. And they fall into all sorts of categories of coincidences. But this one I thought I picked out as something that was a category of its own. She told me this story about getting into a taxi in Chicago one day. 2 years later, she's in a taxi in Miami. And it turns out that she recognizes the cab driver in Miami to be the same person that picked her up in Chicago. And when you prod for this, you find out that, in fact, the taxi driver had albinism. Now, with a person with albinism is going to be very noticeable. And she was picking out somebody she had noticed before. She's a businesswoman who travels the world and takes taxis often in big cities. I would suspect that without noticing, she's been in taxis in different cities with the same taxi driver multiple times. You just don't notice it. And part of coincidence stories, the truth of coincidence stories is in the noticing.
Right, because there are so many things that probably pass by because we're not paying attention or just not primed to notice that something unusual has happened.
That's right. And somebody who just recently was at one of my book readings, he raised the question, if there are coincidences, there must be the non-coincidences. Well, are those non-coincidences? and you have to realize that, yes, he's right. I stumbled over an answer to that, but he is right. And in fact, you know, the things you don't notice might be coincidence as well because you're just not there to see them. So, you know, by meeting somebody in Paris, for example, who is a friend of yours on a street, on one street, you're on the Boulevard Saint-Michel, but on the Rue Saint-Jacques, there's another friend who you probably don't see.
What's the difference, Joseph, between the law of large numbers and the law of truly large numbers?
A very different thing, but they work hand in hand. The law of truly large numbers, without going into the actual formula for the law, it works this way. You have a mathematical probability. We can actually take assign numbers to events that happen. And events that happen very often, you can assign a number which would be a probability. In other words, how often would this such a thing happen? But that could be mathematical. In other words, for example, flipping a coin would be a good example. In other words, what's the odds of what's the probability that by flipping a coin, the coin will land on heads? Well, it's a half. It's a number. The question is, will it actually in real life happen? And so the law of large numbers tells us that, and this law is often confused with a kind of a vague law that says that is incorrect, but it also it's interpreted as, well, if you flip a coin many, many times, the number of heads will become equal to the number of tails, or it'll get closer to the number of tails. Now, that's not true. Hmm. It just isn't true. What is true is that if you have the observations of coin flips over and over and over again, and you do these flips many, many times, the likelihood that the observed number of heads is equal to the mathematical number of projected heads will diminish as the number of events get larger and larger. So in other words, there's no guarantee that it will happen. It generally does happen, but it's only by probability, not by anything exact. So that's the law of large numbers, the real law of large numbers. Now, the law of truly large numbers is completely different. It says that if events are have some kind of likeliness to happen. So, for example, the probability is not zero, then whatever it is, it will happen sometime. Now, that sometime, of course, could be a million years from now or 10 million years from now, but it will happen. And that's the law of truly large numbers. It's not really a mathematical law. It's more of a philosophical law. There's no real way to prove it, although some people will say that there is.
Yeah, what about this, and you take this on in the book, the old adage about, you know, if you give a monkey a typewriter and enough time, it at some point can type out the complete works of Shakespeare.
Yeah, yes. This goes back to 1913. Actually, it goes much, much further back. It goes back to Aristotle even, who does talk a little bit about randomness. But it's in 1913, the mathematician Emil Borel decided to tackle an age-old question about randomness. So the question is this. Could totally random events amount to something meaningful? That is, and to qualify that, I would say the more popular rendition of the question becomes this. Could a monkey randomly hitting the keys of a keyboard type out a Shakespeare sonnet? So the answer to that question is yes. And in mathematics, if that answer is yes, then the monkey could, in theory, type out all the books of the Library of Congress, the largest library in the world. And I compute the odds of the monkey typing the first word shall, as in shall I compare thee to a summer's day. It turns out to be about 8 million to 1, just that one word. So
we need a monkey with a long lifespan.
Well, or 8 million monkeys doing it. Either way, you get it. they've tried to do this with computers. Virtual monkeys have spent more than 42 billion monkey hours before hitting the first 15 characters of the first line of the two gentlemen of Verona.
Wow.
So that's how hard it really is to do it.
Joseph Mazur is my guest. He's emeritus professor of mathematics at Marlborough College and author of a new book called Fluke, The Math and Myth of Coincidence. If you've got a question or a short coincidence story, you can call us at 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Summer Youth Program with hands-on workshops in game design, coding, robotics, visual arts, math, and language arts for students entering grades K through 12 at SMU's Plano campus. Online registration is available at smu.edu/summeryouth.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with Joseph Mazur, who's Emeritus Professor of Mathematics at Marlborough College and author of Fluke, The Math and Myth of Coincidence. Okay, Joseph, walk me through how I could understand this in mathematical terms. I go to the grocery store, buy all the food items that I need for my family, and the bill is exactly $100 with tax. That's not any more likely than it being 104.23 or 96.14, right? It just sticks in my head as being unusual.
Yeah, that's right, because you have to think about all the times you've gone to the grocery store, and the bill has not come to such a exact number, exact even, you know, a perfect number, let's call it. Think about all those grocery bills that you've had in the past. And so, you know, the fact that it came to $100, well, including tax, well, it happens. It happened to me once, and not exactly $100, but something close to it.
Somehow it feels special.
It's just odd.
Yeah.
It feels odd. Yeah, oh, it feels special. That's true. And we think of those moments as being very lucky moments, and that's good, too. We need those lucky moments.
How do you apply...
I don't want to discourage those lucky moments when trying to suggest that these things have reasons to be.
Right, right. How do you apply math and logic to what you call the rocking chair story? This is something that actually happened to you and your wife.
Mm-hmm. Yes. This is a story that my wife was pregnant with my first child, and an aunt gave us some money for a rocking chair. And I noticed in my brother's house a wonderful rocking chair that I really wanted a duplicate of. And so we went hunting for that rocking chair in different stores around Boston and found one, but they didn't have one in stock. So they said, well, we can get one for you. It'd take a month, and we could deliver it to you. And they were going to deliver it to my brother's house in Boston because we live in Vermont, so it would have been... we would just pick it up in Boston. And what happened was turned out that my brother was having a party one day, a few people over, and somebody sat in his rocking chair, and the entire chair collapsed completely and was in splinters. And the poor person fell to the floor, and my brother didn't know what to say. But at that very moment, at that instant, the doorbell rang, and the delivery man came with the exact rocking chair. And so my brother said, "Oh, no problem. We just called for another." And so that's the way the story goes. And why did it happen that way? Well, there are some things that you can. What I do in the book is break down the big story into little stories, and you can get some numbers on the little stories. I want to preface what I'm about to say with this, that, you know, I'm not suggesting that we should focus so much on the numbers in these stories. In other words, I think we should take the numbers as a kind of understanding that some numbers are more surprising than others. So we can categorize these coincidences into categories that have hierarchies. So some are more surprising than others. So when I break down a story into a probability or an odds, then I'm suggesting that the odds of that is something akin to, let's say, a four of a kind in poker or a royal flush in poker or something like that. In other words, how surprising is that story? I'm not concerned about the exact number. We really can't get exact numbers, so that would be a foolish thing to do. However, what we do is we consider the numbers to be giving us some kind of a hierarchy of coincidences. And the way the book is structured is I take 10 coincidence stories, and these coincidence stories are representatives of loads of other coincidence stories, and they're disconnected in some way. So they're categories of stories, like, for example, meeting a friend in a foreign city. The rocking chair story is very different than the meeting a friend in a foreign city because there's a kind of an ingredient of exact timing to be made there. So there is a lot of ingredients that separate these stories into categories. But once I get the categories, I try to get some odds involved and compute the numbers, but I'm not terribly serious about the exact numbers. I'm just saying, well, one is a little bit more surprising than the other.
So there are some stories, like there's a story of these two people who were mistaken for two other people with the same
That's
name.
That's a wonderful story. Yeah.
Tell us about
yes.
them.
Yes. Yes. This was told to me. I was in a van. My wife and I were taking an Italian lesson. We were enrolled in an Italian language school in Sardinia, in Olbia, Sardinia, a little town in, well, it's not so little, but probably about 30,000 people on the islands of Sardinia. And the story was told to me by the director of the school. And somebody asked, how did the school begin? And he told this story of the first day of school, that the school was founded by him, and it was the first day of school. And he was to meet a woman by the name of Manuela. And she was coming from Madrid. And he was to meet her in the lobby of her hotel and go on an excursion, which was the usual thing for this school, to take people on excursions to show them the countryside. Well, he met Manuela, and the excursion was going to involve a boat ride, but they were about an hour ahead of time. So he said, well, let's go for a coffee. And so they leave the hotel, they go for a coffee, and the two of them are discussing their lives and, you know, the little chit-chat that would happen with two people who have just met each other. And after about an hour of talking, the director, his name is Francesco. Francesco asks Manuela, so why do you want – your Italian is so good. Why do you want to learn? Come to an Italian language school? And she said, Italian language school? I don't want to go to Italian language school. I'm here to meet so-and-so, Francesco somebody or other. He is I'm interviewing him. He's interviewing me for a job. And so the two of them realize that, in fact, they are in the wrong place, the wrong Francesco and the wrong Manuela, and they go back to the hotel, and there in the hotel lobby is a couple, Francesco and Manuela, and they're still chatting, and they still do not know that they are the wrong Francesco and Manuela. So that is the story, and it's a wonderful story, I think. But in the book, I break it down, and that's what you have to do. You have to connect the dots. Why is this happening? How often does it happen? And you can get some numbers here because you know how many – you can look at the phone books. How many Manuelas are there? How many Francescos are there? You can find out numbers. How many Manuelas came to Olbia? It's an island, remember, so the people that's a destination for people. How many Manuelas came on Iberia Airways from Madrid? You know, this breakdown, you can get some numbers. I'm not saying they're exact, but they are numbers that you can get a handle on. And then you ask the question: well, do the two names, Francesco and Manuela, mean anything? Is that important? No, just two names. And so you start to think, well, this must be happening all over the world. People are meeting each other, and they're misidentifying each other. And you can do this everywhere. And then you realize it's when you start to look at the numbers for all over the world, you realize that, in fact, it's got to be happening as we speak.
To someone named Francesco and someone named Manuel, or
not necessarily no. Those two names. In other words, just change the names.
Right.
You know, it's the fact that the story doesn't really depend on the names. It depends on the misidentified meeting.
All right. Let's go to the phones now at 1-800-933-5372. We have Donna on the line in Frisco. Hi, Donna.
Hi, Chris. I love this show. Quick story. Chris, your predecessor, the wonderful Glenn Mitchell, interviewed Pat Conroy, one of my favorite authors. Mm-hmm. As you probably know, he wrote The Great Santini about his life, The Prince of Tides, also about his life. And they made movies of both. All right. I was in New York in 2001, and I was waiting to go to lunch. And the doors open of the restaurant. Out comes one of my favorite actors, Robert Duvall. And, you know, I had to say something to him, of course. And he was very gracious. Then the next night, I'm at Lincoln Center. I'm seeing a Harold Pinter play. At the intermission, I'm getting coffee. Next to me is a lady, and I look, it's Blythe Danner. And, of course, I started talking to her, and we chatted. Okay, 2 weeks later, I've moved to Texas. I call in on the Glenn Mitchell Show. He's interviewing Pat Conroy, and I said, excuse me, but weren't Robert Duvall and Blythe Danner in the movie The Great Santini? He goes, yeah, they played my parents. I said, oh, my gosh, what are the chances of this happening? Glenn Mitchell goes, Donna, Pat arranged this for you.
Donna, thank you so much.
That's very good. I like that. That's a really sweet story. That's great.
Do you find...
You don't want me to break that one down. I don't want to break that one down.
I guess...
It's too nice.
Maybe what you'll say, what you would say, let me see if I'm following you correctly here.
Well, the first thing I wrote down in my notes as Donna was talking is that, well, look, you're in New York. New York is going to have lots of writers and lots of movie stars. And, you know, that combination is going to be there. And, you know, you bump into a lot of people. And if you recognize them, you'll see them everywhere in New York.
Right. And then, of course, she would notice them more than she would notice anybody else on the street
exactly.
Who wasn't notable.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
All right.
But still, I mean, that being said, it is a wonderful story.
It sure is. And you were saying that people, once they know that you're writing about coincidence, share their stories with you. You must just have just a giant catalog of these.
Tons, yeah. You spend a couple of years writing a book like this, and then you feel, I'm going to have to write another book and include more stories. Because the stories that I heard after writing the book are super stories. They really are super stories. I've got quite a few that are very nice.
What are the odds that somebody might win the lottery? Not once, not twice, but four times.
The odds, actually, if you really want to know, pretty good.
Then what do I do to get on that track?
Well, here's the thing. You know, it's been reputed that winning the audit, this is, you're referring to Joan Ginther, who is a Texan, in fact, who won the lottery four times. And it's been reputed that the odds of doing that is 18 septillion to one. So it could take, you know, 1,000 years to, or many more than 1,000 years to actually perform something like that. But that's only in retrospect. In other words, we now know that somebody by the name of Joan Ginther has won the lottery four times. If we were to play it the other way without the retrospective understanding, we would see that we would think of it this way. We would think, what are the odds of anybody winning the lottery four times? And that's the thing that you see in the news. In other words, somebody won the lottery four times. When we name Joan Ginther, we can't name her ahead of time because that would be the 18 septillion to one. But once we know that a person by the name of Joan Ginther has won the lottery, well, it's really about 8 million to one odds. I actually compute that in the book, and it's about 8 million to one odds. It's not too bad, you know? In fact, I would say it happens very regularly, but we don't notice it in the news. You know, there's so many lotteries in this country. You know, Joan won the first lottery, I believe it was, I'm just trying to remember, it was $5.4 million she won that. But that first lottery was a real lottery. And then some years later, she won another lottery with $3 million, and then $2 million, and then $10 million. But the other three lotteries were scratch-offs. So people were thinking, did she have some kind of an algorithm to she happened to be she happened to be a I happen to have a PhD in mathematics from Stanford, and she was a professor, or at least she taught. I'm not sure she was a professor because I tried to find this out, but I was not able to. I know she taught statistics as well. So the assumption is she sort of gamed the system or she knew something about an algorithm. Now, algorithm is a kind of a strong word. I mean, I use it lightly in my book, but an algorithm, she did not have an algorithm because an algorithm suggests something else. An algorithm is kind of like a machine. You put something in, you get something out. You know, in her case, she may have put something in, but whatever she got out was not precisely what you would expect to get out. In other words, there's a probability that she would get something out, but it's only a likelihood that she would get it out. That again goes back to the law of large numbers and the discrepancy between the law of large numbers that people usually think of and the what we call the weak law of large numbers, the one I described earlier. So one thing that you can she could have done is with scratch-off tickets, it's a little bit different than with winning the big lottery. You know, she won three lotteries in two-year segments, you know, 2 years between each lottery, 2 years go by. And there are things you could do. First off, you know, the fact that she won $5.4 million the first time means that she has a lot of money to invest in the next bunch of tickets. Hmm. Now, that's something that most of us don't have. You know, it's just it's what psychologists call house money. And almost all people who bet on the lottery or invest in the lottery or gamble even, when they win and they win large amounts, they think of it as free money and it's money easily spent. And usually it's spent on trying to win again.
My guest is Joseph Mazur, Emeritus Professor of Mathematics at Marlborough College. His new book is called Fluke, The Math and Myth of Coincidence. You can ask a question or share a story at 1-800-933-5372. You can also find me on Twitter. I'm at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Summer Youth Program with hands-on workshops in game design, coding, robotics, visual arts, math, and language arts for students entering grades K through 12 at SMU's Plano campus. Online registration is available at smu.edu/summeryouth.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour to Emeritus Mathematics Professor Joseph Mazur from Marlborough College. His new book is called Fluke, The Math and Myth of Coincidence. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372. Joseph, what do we do with those stories that seem to involve something like extrasensory perception, people knowing things they couldn't possibly have known?
Well, it's you know, you're talking about telepathy, clairvoyance, and that sort of thing. There's a whole section in the book, and, you know, this is a section, the fourth section, which I call head scratchers. You know, once I categorize the stories, I try to analyze all of these stories, and then there was a point where there were a bunch of stories that I just couldn't really get to. I mean, I really just couldn't do this. So there are the head scratchers, and that's one of them, the ESP. There's a wonderful story in that section that involves a mob boss and his girlfriend. The girlfriend is somehow having an affair with somebody, and the mob boss is about to kill them both, actually, I believe. This is in Brazil, by the way, so it's not here in this country, but it's in Brazil, and that's very significant to say that. And the in the ensuing hit, let's call it, it turns out that the boss is the one who gets killed, and His girlfriend is tried, and she is tried for murder of the mob boss. Now, as it turns out that she produces a letter that the boss writes from the other side. In other words, he's dead, and he wrote this letter. And he writes this letter saying that, in fact, she did not kill him, that he was killed in some other way, and she should be exonerated and she should not be tried for a murder. Now, the court looks at this letter, and it turns out that there are many such letters in Brazil that happen like that. In other words, there's a kind of a 90% belief that, in fact, there is some kind of telepathy that's going on from the other side, from the other world. And this is the way it is in Brazil, and turns out that the court actually accepted that this letter was actually authentic. It was written by a dead person. So that's one story that is very extraordinary, but it's a true story.
What seems most extraordinary is that anyone believed that.
Well, in Brazil, they do believe it because there's all sorts of belief in ESP and clairvoyance, and it's just very, very part of the culture.
All right, let's go back to the phones now and speak with Ken in Garland. Hey, Ken.
Oh, hi, Chris. How you doing? Listen, I got a quick question. Well, not a quick one, but for the Professor Mazur, the game of card game of blackjack. Okay. Now, the dealers statistically will bust once every 3.8 hands, and I'm wondering if I walk up to a blackjack table and don't bet any money, but watch the dealer until they don't bust, say, 4 or 5 times, then put all my money down and don't take any cards that will bust me in hopes that the dealer will bust. Is there any validity to that?
You know, one has to be careful about saying yes or no to a question like that. I'm not insured to say those things. But, you know, I can't really say, and I don't think that it's – I don't think there is a way to do that. But I really can't say that you should do this, because if you lose a lot of money in blackjack, that's – you know, I don't want to be responsible for that.
But is there any there's no greater chance than in any of the previous hands that would be the one that they would bust in, right?
I don't think so. I don't think so. But I may be wrong about that.
All right.
I'm just not equipped to know enough about how that is actually how one would see that.
All right. 1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go to Alan in Fort Worth. Hi, Alan.
Hi, how are you today?
Very well, thanks.
I'll be real brief. I love your show. But when I was 12 years old, I lived in Weatherford, Texas, and I was a paper boy. I delivered papers to this bakery. About 22 years later, I had moved to Southern California. I went to Tahoe to go skiing. I called a babysitter. The lady that answered the door was the same, the same baker that I used to deliver papers to at Weatherford. My brother was in school 4 years before me, was also in Tahoe and met her. My brother-in-law used to buy pastries from her 12 years later, and he was there. What are the chances on that?
Yeah, well, that's... Yeah, the same woman, exactly the same woman. That's, yeah. Well, the question is how many people did not meet her? That's another, that you have to look at it that way too. How many of your friends did not meet her? And of course, where was she staying at that, the second time? What in?
Let's find it. Oh, excuse me.
Are you there?
Hang on. I got to bring him back up on the phone. I think actually, okay. Let's see. That was Alan in Fort Worth. Hi, Alan.
Yes. You hear me?
Yes.
Yes.
Okay,
so
she was actually coming to the hotel. She was in a babysitting service. and she came to the hotel where I was in Lake Tahoe.
Oh, so it was a babysitting service. What was she babysitting for your baby the first time and then the next time for somebody else's baby? So in other words, she's not in her house and people are knocking on her door in a house. In other words, she is actually in a service of some sort. And it's a very
Correct.
Unique service, right?
Correct, yes.
So it's a unique service, babysitting for a particular hotel, in fact. Is that right?
That's right, yes.
Yeah. So now, you see where I'm going with this? I mean, we can't crunch the numbers about this, but you see where I'm going with it. In other words, she is in a fairly unique service at a particular hotel, and that hotel, I don't know what the hotel is, but is that a hotel that would be likely, you know, when I talked about earlier, our neighborhoods that move along with us. In other words, the fact that that's a hotel that you would probably frequent, and probably your friends might frequent that kind of a hotel as well. So, in other words, when you break it down that way, you start to look for, you know, what are the ingredients of common neighborhood people that would do the same kinds of things that you would do, and perhaps when we're talking about babies, it must be also somewhat in your age group as well.
So, still a cool story for Alan and his family.
Yeah,
but
yeah, it is.
But doesn't defy explanation.
It does not. I agree.
All right, let's go now to Nicole in Dallas. Hi, Nicole.
Hi there. I have met in my entire life three people whose families are Panamanian. The first one I met in college, the second one I met when I lived in New Orleans, and the third one I met here. And the one in New Orleans was named Argelis Roski, which I always found unusual that somebody from Panama had a Polish name. So I was hanging out with a new friend in Dallas 8 to 10 years later, and we were talking about her family in Panama, and she mentioned that her mother was of Polish heritage in Panama. And I said, that's really weird because, you know, one of the two other people I've ever met from Panama, her name was Roski. She had a Polish name. And so my new friend starts going, Roski, Roski, that's my mother's name. So it turns out these two are first cousins. Argy's father and Gail's mother are sister and brother.
All right, what do you do with that one, Joseph?
Okay, well, these are wonderful stories, you're pressing me to somehow deflate them. I can't deflate them. However, I would suggest that the fact that there's a certain piece of noticing going on here, because immediately this is a Panamanian. And you know that it's a strange name for a Panamanian. That is, Roski is strange, a Polish name for a Panamanian. And now that's already clicking with you. You know, there's a certain click that has happened. So any time you're going to get something that is going to have a Polish name with a Panamanian, you're going to notice that. So again, it goes back to the taxi driver with albinism, a little bit, although this is a little bit less noticeable than that. Still, it's a great story.
Okay, we have an email here from Steve who wants to know if you have a name for this phenomenon. I am reading while listening to the radio, and at the exact moment I am reading a word, it is spoken in a radio story. I need a name for it.
You know, this has been asked me several times already. I know there must be one. We should make one up if there isn't. But it has been asked me. It's, again, that is in the noticing. You can imagine that. And it happens all the time. I mean, you know, you buy a new blue, let's say, Chevrolet, and suddenly you've never had a Chevrolet in your life before. Your cars are never blue. And suddenly you find everybody on the road is riding in a blue Chevrolet, and it's, perhaps even the model that you bought. It's a sudden noticing. And so there is that. It's a phenomenon. You're woken up to the noticing.
All right.
But, yeah, there should be a name for it.
I guess that can be, you can, if you have a second edition to your book, you can come up with a name and decide that you own it. let's see, here's another email from Kevin who says, one of my favorite books is Neverending Story. One day a few years ago, I was discussing with a friend. A few days later, we were filming a music video at an abandoned hospital, and in the library, the only book out on the table was Neverending Story.
Yeah, again, that's the noticing. Hmm. There it is. It happens all the time. It really does happen more often than we think. And you know, if we're aware of things, if we become more aware of these things, we will notice that these coincidences are happening all over, every time. You know, I'll just tell you one coincidence. I was to come to this. I'm actually broadcasting this from Springfield, Massachusetts,
right.
And I had to get here on time for this broadcast. Now, what are the coincidences that this building would be just at the corner of a main break?
Water main break, sewer, you guys are dealing
water,
with. Right.
A sewer water main break. Just think of that, okay? So I couldn't get into the building. There's no way I can get in the building. I had to go walking through the muck. My feet are wet right now. But I had to walk through the muck, and the police wouldn't even let me near the building, but managed to sneak around, and I got into the building just in time to do this. Now, you know, what are the chances of that? Okay.
Well, I'm sorry that your shoes are ruined, but I'm
no,
glad
they're not ruined. They're okay,
that we kept you on the line for an hour. Our conversation does make me think, you know, you talk so much about, you know, so many of these coincidences exist because we notice them. Do you feel like, you know, having worked on this research and on this book, are you paying closer attention so that you can discover more attractive, interesting coincidences?
You know, I get 5 or 6 or 7 of them a day, and sometimes even more in email. You know, so I don't have time to notice anything anymore. But what's a coincidence but these stories that are coming to me right and left? It's wonderful. I mean, I just really they're fantastic stories, and I wish I had time to tell some of them, because some of them are really even far more fantastic than the ones I have in this book. I mean, there really are terrific stories that are out there. I wish I had another 2 years to write the same book, and then I'd include those.
But well, again, volume two. There we go.
Yeah.
Joseph Mazur is Emeritus Professor of Mathematics at Marlborough College. His new book is called Fluke, The Math and Myth of Coincidence. Joseph, we really are glad that you made it to the studio and had time to talk to us today. Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you for having me. This is wonderful. Wonderful to be here.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy, with help on the phones today for the last time from our amazing intern, Tori Whitley. Samantha Guzman is our associate producer, and our executive producer is Jeff Whittington. I'm on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think, and you can contact the show via email at think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.